body by a ribbon of flesh. The highwayman slumped to the ground, whimpering unnaturally as his intestines poured from his stomach on a tide of crimson blood. A moment later, he was still. Jeroen stepped over the corpse and retrieved his sword. Standing motionlessly by Fergus's body, he waited until the torches of Andokai's guardsmen appeared in the distance. Then, as the jangling armor grew louder, he slipped into the night. Chapter 5. Northern Goregar, Girdlegard, Spring, 6235th Solar Cycle. 5 orbits had passed since Tungdil and Boindil left the Fifthling Kingdom with a company of 10 warriors on their way south through the sparsely populated countryside of Goregar. They were looking for an entrance to the underground network, the location of which was marked on Tungdil's map. Springtime had arrived in northern Goregar, breaking many cycles of bondage to the perished land. It seemed to the dwarfs that everything was blossoming and burgeoning with new vitality. The flowers seemed to drip with honey-yellow nectar, and the pure country air was abuzz with industrious bees. Not that the party, with the exception of Tungdil, took much interest in the scenery. In their view, nothing compared to the beauty of underground halls. Most were unaccustomed to daylight and resented the sunshine because it dazzled their eyes. To save their sight, they broke camp before dawn, slept in the afternoon, and walked from dusk until the middle of the night. It was Tungdil and Boindil's second journey south from the Grey Range. On the first occasion, many orbits previously, they had set off with the newly forged Keenfire, stopping in Alandor to throw off their pursuers, confident that neither Nodon nor his orcish army would think to look for them in the home of their ancient foes. This time they travelled due south, making straight for the nearest entrance to the underground network. Their mission was to find the outcasts, a mysterious group of dwarves who haunted the tunnels. No one knew exactly where they lived. The company had left the Fifthling Kingdom in a hurry, which suited Tungdil on several counts. For one thing, preparations were underway for Belindis's melding with the new Fifthling King, and he didn't want to add to his heartache by sticking around for the banquet. Quite apart from that, time was running out. Ushnot's scouts had made it as far as the Northern Pass, which meant the rest of the Orcish army would be following close behind. Tungdil needed to find some reinforcements and get them to the Fifthling Kingdom before the hordes arrived, and he couldn't discount the possibility of a separate invasion from the Outer Lands. The journey passed mainly in silence. The exertion of marching, coupled with the weight of bedrolls and provisions, limited their conversation to the briefest of exchanges. Boindil, whose thoughts were with his brother, barely said a word. It had taken considerable effort to persuade him to leave his frozen twin, and he had done so only on the basis that Boendal had no use for his axes, whereas Tungdil did. On the morning of the sixth orbit, they spotted the walls of a settlement. Adjusting his course, Tungdil made a beeline for the city. "Boindil and I will find out what we can about the orcs. The rest of you get some sleep and be ready to leave this evening. With a bit of luck, we'll reach the tunnels by dawn." Entering the city through the main gates, they were surprised by the lack of guards. By the time they made their way through the winding maze of narrow alleys, they were actually aware of the silence.
"Humans are rarer than diamonds in this city," grumbled Boindil. "Do you think they've died of the plague?"
They headed for the nearest tavern to look for some answers. The publican, a hirsute fellow of some 40 cycles with the yellowest teeth that Tungdil had ever seen, practically fell over himself to welcome them.
"It's an honour to receive such distinguished guests," he said with a bow. "Hilchester welcomes you."
He wiped his greasy hands on his apron.
"I'll give you my best room, of course, but I expect you're in hurry to get to the market. The sun ceremony is the highlight of the cycle."
Boindil and the others stared at him in bemusement. They weren't used to human ways.
"No wonder," whispered Tungdil. "Everyone's at the marketplace."
He followed the publican up the creaking staircase.
"I'll explain in a moment," he hissed to Boindil.
The publican rushed away and came back seconds later with a tub of water. While they washed the dust off their faces, Tungdil told them what he knew about the sun ceremony. "It's a cyclical festival with stands, selling food and drink and all kinds of attractions. There'll be peddlers and hawkers and music and dancing. Boindil and I will head over there now. If it's worth seeing, the rest of you can take a look later. You'll have something to tell the others back home."
"Don't wait for me," said Boindil, shooing him away. "If we search the city separately, we'll be done in half the time."
"Only if you promise to talk to them politely," said Tungdil cautiously, remembering an earlier incident involving singed whiskers and an altercation in a tavern. It was a miracle that no one had been killed.
"Don't worry, scholar. I know how to deal with long'uns," breezed Boindil, steering him out of the room. "See you at dusk."
"Very well," said Tungdil with a smile. "But I don't want to have to break up any fights." He closed the door behind him. The spacious bar was remarkably empty. Sitting in the corner by the remains of the fire was a lone guest who, judging by his outfit, wasn't a regular drinker at the tavern. He was wearing an expensively tailored tunic and knickerbockers of the finest cloth. His thin legs were clad in tights, and his fancy shoes were adorned with sparkling silver buckles. A ridiculous little hat perched on his bobbed black hair. He was clean-shaven and smelled as perfumed as a lady. Tungdil couldn't help grinning at his preposterous attire. To his astonishment, the man jumped to his feet and hurried over.
"There you are! I was beginning to think you weren't coming,"
he exclaimed, visibly relieved.
"I'm Truck Elias. I'll show you the way."
Without waiting for a response, he turned and strode to the door. Tungdil scratched his beard.
"I'm afraid I don't..."
"Hurry up,"
the man said sharply.
"Come on, groundling. Your services are required.
We're late enough already."
His pointed shoes drummed impatiently against the floor.
"Oh,"
said Tungdil. He knew that most itinerant dwarves were blacksmiths, and it wasn't uncommon for humans to assume that all dwarves were metal workers. Still, blacksmiths weren't in the habit of carrying weapons like keen fire. The man was obviously stupid or blind.
"You should probably ask someone else. I'm a bit out of practice."
"Nonsense! Any groundling could handle a job like this."
The man's blue eyes narrowed to slits.
"Is this about money?"
he asked suspiciously.
"You'll get the same as the others and not a penny more. Another word and I'll report you as a troublemaker. You won't be hired in Hillchester again."
Tungdil decided to play along. Metalwork came easily to him, and it would be a good opportunity to ask some questions about the orcs. Besides, he didn't want the citizens of Hillchester to think that his kinsfolk were unreliable. Unlike gnomes and kobolds, the children of Vrakas could be trusted to keep their word.
"I'll do what I can, but it might take longer than usual, and I'm not a groundling. I'm a dwarf."
Elias laughed.
"After the first few strokes, you'll be fine."
Tungdil had a sudden thought.
"I haven't brought any tools."
"We've got everything set up for you," said Elias, pointing to the door. "Let's go."
They hurried through the alleyways, heading for the centre of Hillchester. Tungdil found himself jogging to keep up with the long-legged man. Judging by the number of people who greeted them, Elias was a well-known personality in the town. After a while, it dawned on the wheezing Tungdil that Truck wasn't a forename, as he had supposed, but an honorific title. It seemed likely that his new employer was in the service of King Bruron. Ahead of them, the alleyway broadened, opening into a proper street. Tungdil detected the hum of several hundred voices. They were still some distance away, but Tungdil guessed from the music and laughter that the festivities were in full swing. Truck Elias rounded a corner and came to a halt. Tungdil stared at the vast gathering of people. From his standpoint, their legs and torsos formed a single, impenetrable wall. There was no way through. His pessimism wasn't shared by Elias, who clearly thought it beneath him to make a detour around the square.
"Out of the way!" he shouted, stepping briskly into the marketplace. "Out of the way, citizens of Hillchester!"
The crowd separated obediently, allowing the man and his stocky companion to pass. After a while, Tungdil noticed a big wooden stage in the middle of the square. They seemed to be heading straight for it. Standing on the rectangular platform were four soldiers and eight civilians, dressed in nothing but thin, grubby rags. Steel handcuffs encircled their wrists, and blindfolds covered their eyes.
"It looks like an execution," thought Tungdil, confused.
Looking around, he realized that the festivities weren't quite as harmless as he had imagined. The citizens of Hillchester were celebrating the imminent death of eight of their number, three women and five men. Elias ascended the steps to the platform, pausing when he realized that Tungdil had stopped.
"Get a move on,"
he ordered, signaling for him to follow. It finally dawned on Tungdil that their route through the marketplace wasn't a shortcut to the forge.
"He thinks I'm an executioner."
Tungdil stepped back.
"There's been a mistake," he said loudly. "I'm not an executioner."
The crowd gasped. Elias strode down the steps toward him.
"What's this?"
he hissed.
"I warned you not to haggle. The rabble wants blood. If you don't kill the prisoners, they'll settle for yours."
He scrabbled around in his purse and pressed a few coins into Tungdil's hand.
"All right. Here's a little extra from me. Now get up there and do your job."
"You don't understand," said Tungdil, determined to put an end to the confusion. "I am not an executioner. My name is Tungdil Goldhand. I'm here on a..."
"Tungdil? I don't know any Tungdils,"
said Elias, taken aback.
"We hired Bramdal, the best itinerant executioner in Goregar."
The crowd's surprise turned to anger. It was clear from the shouts and jeers that they weren't prepared to wait. Elias glared at the dwarf.
"I don't care what your name is or who you are. All I need is a groundling."
He grabbed Tungdil's shoulder and tried to drag him up the stairs, but the dwarf was determined not to budge.
"Keep this up and I'll have you arrested," threatened Elias. "I order you to behead them."
"No,"
said Tungdil, giving up on Elias and deciding to chance it with the crowd. The man seemed to fear the citizens of Hillchester, which Tungdil took as a positive sign. His legs carried him up the stairs and onto the podium. A loud cheer went up from the assembled masses when the dwarf appeared on the stage. Tungdil looked at the rows of crazed faces all baying for blood and suspected that Elias was right. No one would leave the stage alive unless the execution went ahead. He and the eight prisoners were trapped. The executioner's block was at the center of the stage. The furrowed wood was stained with patches of dark red blood and bore the marks of countless executions. A broad-bladed axe lay two paces to the side. The guards pushed a woman to the front of the stage. After a quick drum roll, a herald read out her name and her crime. Tungdil gathered that his first victim was a disloyal spouse. The woman's husband had died, and she had been seen with a new suitor before the full period of mourning had elapsed. She wasn't a murderer or a violent criminal. Her only crime was love. Love. He suddenly thought of Belindis. The woman was dragged to the executioner's block and forced to her knees. The guard's movements were forceful and precise. He pushed her head against the wood, seized her long hair,
and wrapped it around a metal pole. Now her neck was exposed, and she couldn't turn her head or move. The drumming grew louder and faster. A violent shove sent Tungdil stumbling forward. His hand touched the woman's back, and he felt her shaking body through the flimsy fabric of her vest. Her sobs were barely audible, which made him pity her all the more. He stared at the soft, smooth skin on her neck and shoulders. She was only a girl, condemned to death by a law that, in Tungdil's opinion, was downright absurd. If the humans want to kill her, they should do it themselves.
"What are you waiting for?" snarled the guard. "Hurry up and chop off her head. There's another 7 to go."
"For the last time, I'm not an executioner," shouted Tungdil, holding keen fire in the air. "My name is Tungdil Goldhand. This blade killed Nodon and freed you from the perished land. I'm not your henchman."
He picked up the executioner's axe and held it out for the guard to take.
"Here, do it yourself if you're so keen for her to die. I won't do it for you."
His speech caused an uproar. Pushing and shoving, the crowd surged forward, determined to see blood.
"Now look what you've done, you stupid groundling," snapped Elias, staring fearfully at the mob.
It was clear that the soldiers were barely able to restrain the frenzied crowd. Tungdil offered him the axe without a word.
"What are you doing? I'm not an executioner. I'm a track,"
said Elias indignantly. He stooped down and shoved his face into Tungdil's, filling the dwarf's nostrils with his perfume.
"You'll rot in prison for this, groundling,"
he hissed with a shake of his ridiculous little hat.
"Although I've a mind to throw you to the crowd."
Another cheer went up, louder and more triumphant. Tungdil and Elias swung round. A powerfully built dwarf was limping across the stage toward them. He was dressed in black, with brown leather armor and heavy boots. His features were hidden by a leather mask, and long, fair braids hung down from his chin. His footsteps thudded against the plank floor.
"I was delayed," he said tersely.
Without another word, he took the executioner's axe from Tungdil and marched to the block. He didn't stop to take aim, just hefted the weapon with two hands and swung it mid-stride. The blade cut a whistling arc through the air and connected with the prisoner's neck, killing her outright. Her head thudded to the floor, and blood spurted from the grisly stump. Her headless torso twitched a final time, showering the front row of spectators with droplets of blood. Then her body fell from the block. The black-clad dwarf sliced through her hair to free the head from the pole. He held it up for the crowd to see. The axe had chopped cleanly through skin, sinew, and bone. Bramdel certainly knew his stuff.
"Get out of my sight!"
hissed Elias to Tungdil, who quickly obliged. Hurrying away from the stage, he found himself a spot not far from the marketplace and settled down to wait for Bramdel. It didn't occur to him to return Elias's money. Gold was gold. The crowd cheered for a bit, then went quiet, a pattern that repeated itself at irregular intervals another 7 times. Then the music started, and the citizens of Hillchester laughed, cheered, danced, and celebrated, while the severed heads were hoisted on flagpoles next to the stage. A short while later, the black-clad dwarf appeared at Tungdil's side. A few specks of gore flecked his boots and his armor, but his clothes bore no trace of his grisly work. Tungdil looked him up and down. His leather mask was dangling from his belt.
"I heard about the mix-up," laughed the executioner. "It's not often I'm mistaken for another dwarf."
He held out his hand.
"I'm Bramdel Masterstroke."
There was a pause while he waited for Tungdil's reply. Tungdil studied his features. Bramdel Masterstroke, professional executioner. was many cycles older than he was, but his deep brown eyes were bright and shiny. Despite his gruesome trade and the many deaths he had witnessed, he seemed neither gloomy nor remorseful. Tungdil cleared his throat. "Why do you do this?" he demanded, gesturing toward the 8 heads hoisted from the flagpoles.
"Why not? Some dwarfs are smiths, some are bakers, and I'm an executioner. It's just a trade."
His eyes smiled at Tungdil from under the black headscarf that covered his fair hair. His cheeks were shaven, except for a small circle round his mouth and chin.
"Shall we go somewhere quieter?"
They set off down the alleyway.
"Which kingdom are you from, Tungdil Goldhand?"
inquired the executioner in a soft, gentle voice.
"I'd like to hear news of my kinsfolk. It's a rare pleasure to meet another dwarf, and you don't look like a tinker or a travelling smith. Are you in exile?"
"I was going to ask you the same," said Tungdil, thanking Vrakas for introducing him to the dwarf. In spite of the initially uncompromising circumstances of their encounter, it looked as though Bramdil might be the key to locating the tunnel-dwelling dwarfs.
"Are you an outcast?" he demanded.
Bramdil laughed.
"Yes, and no. I've found a new home far away from the other folks. I didn't like the rules in my kingdom, so I broke them on purpose. I'm an exile by choice."
He played with his corn-coloured braids.
"Nothing would induce me to go back. How about you?"
Tungdil was about to introduce himself properly and explain the nature of his mission and the fortuitousness of their encounter, when he suddenly thought the better of it and decided to let Bramdil think that he was an outcast too.
"I loved a maiden, and her heart belonged to me, but she was promised to someone else. I killed him in a quarrel."
The lie came easily, too easily. He looked away. Bramdil nodded.
"Not all of our laws are just, and it's time they were changed."
He looked at Tungdil intently.
"What if I were to tell you that there's a place where dwarves aren't tied to the precepts of family and clan?"
He stopped in front of a tavern and held the door open for Tungdil, who was digesting the news. They sat down by the fire, and the executioner ordered 2 beers.
"Is there really such a place?" asked Tungdil, after taking a long draught of beer.
Bramdil nodded.
"There is indeed, Tungdil Goldhand. It's a place where dwarves live together as equals, free from the tyranny of traditions and laws. Isn't it chaos?" "We still have rules," admitted the executioner. "The king and queen make sure we stick to them, but it's basic stuff about working for the common good and not harming each other. There's nothing about clan law and other bunkum. We're equals, and no one can tell us what to do."
Tungdil looked at Bramdil over the rim of his tankard.
"So why are you in Goregar, chopping off heads?"
"For the money, of course," the executioner said coolly. "I used to be really busy when the parish land was still around. With revenants all over the place, my skills were in demand. Besides, I like to help humans. It's our Vrakas-given task."
"Help them?" exclaimed Tungdil. "You've made it your business to kill them. How does that make you different to an orc?"
"I'm protecting them from themselves. I don't kill for the sake of killing. My duty is to clear out the dross. Vrakas wants us to help the humans, so I rid them of the lawbreakers like the 8 men and women on the stage. A quick blow to the neck, and the city is a safer place. Criminals are as dangerous as orcs."
"What about the widow who didn't stick to the mourning period? Was she a danger?"
"She broke the law, and that's the danger. It's not my place to question their laws," said Bramdil, emptying his tankard. "It's stupid to have too many laws, but it's important to keep the ones you've got. Humans, elves, dwarves, we're all the same."
He cocked his head.
"You didn't answer my question," he said.
"What question?"
"About your lineage."
"I'm a..."
He stopped short, unsure of what to say. The beer and the memory of Belindis weighed on his heart.
"Only a thirdling would hesitate like that," observed Bramble. His voice was calm and non-judgmental. "You're not obliged to answer. In any case, lineage doesn't matter where I come from."
Tungdil leaned forward.
"Do you mean you've got thirdlings in your kingdom?"
Bramdel roared with laughter, delighted by Tungdil's amazement.
"Our halls are open to all exiles, regardless of where they come from, including members of the Thirdling Kingdom. All we ask is that everyone sticks to the rules. If they don't..."
He laid his right hand on his axe. The executioner's explanation only added to Tungdil's confusion. He was looking forward to seeing the outcast's kingdom for himself.
"How do I get there?" he asked. "I'd like to visit the place you speak of. Are you sure they'll let me in?"
Ramdel gave him directions to a pond that Tungdil judged to be located near the entrance to the tunnels.
"Strap weights to your ankles and jump into the pool. It's important to sink to the very bottom. Only then will you be admitted to the Freeling's halls."
"Is that what you call yourselves?"
"Free by nature, free by name."
Glancing up, Bramdel spotted a man sitting two tables to their left.
"I'll be back in a moment," he said,
picking up his rucksack and limping across the bar. He and the man talked in hushed tones. Tungdil wasn't sure what to make of the instructions. Dwarves were famously suspicious of water regardless of the depth. He still had painful memories of travelling across Girdlegard with the twins, neither of whom would set foot on a boat, resulting in constant detours. Like most of their kinsfolk, they believed that contact with water would lead to certain death. In their opinion, any lake, tarn, river, or stream outside a dwarven kingdom was a threat.
"How am I going to get Boindil to weigh himself down and jump into a pond when he won't even tread in a puddle?"
Tungdil leaned back in his chair and racked his brains. He had to hand it to the outlaws. It was the perfect way of hiding their existence from the other folks.
"It's going to be a real challenge."
He watched the man push a couple of coins toward Bramdel, in return for which he was handed a small object wrapped in cloth.
"What was that about?"
asked Tungdil noisily when the executioner returned.
"You don't want to know. It's superstitious human stuff," replied Bramdel in a tone that was affable but firm.
Rather than press him for details that he probably wouldn't get, he tried another tack. It had occurred to him that some of the dwarf-like inhabitants from the outer lands might have crossed into Girdlegard, and he wondered whether Bramdel might have met one.
"You've been living with the Freelings for a while. Have you ever seen an undergroundling in your realm?"
He ran a finger around the rim of his tankard and traced a moist rune on the tabletop. It was the mysterious symbol from the cave.
"Do you know what this means?"
Bramdel raised his eyebrows.
"No idea. Undergroundlings, did you say?"
It was too much to hope for.
"It's just a rumor I've heard of. Where are you heading now? The roads aren't safe at the moment. An army of orcs is marching north toward the Grey Range. We had a run-in with some of their scouts."
The executioner shook his head, braids flying to the side.
"It's all right. I'm on my way south. I'm needed in the next city. The prisons are overflowing with criminals and justice must be done."
He held out his hand.
"It was a pleasure to meet you, Tungdil Goldhand,"
he said solemnly.
"Perhaps our paths will cross again. I hope I've been of some assistance. May Vrakas guide you to your goal."
He shouldered his rucksack and limped to the door. Outside it was pouring with rain. Bramdel took a step back, put up his hood, and slipped away.
"Excuse me, but do you happen to know what the executioner sold to that man?"
asked Tungdil, when the publican collected his empty tankard. The man bent down and whispered in his ear. Tungdil's eyes widened. Bramdel was trading in body parts.
"They make excellent talismans,"
explained the publican. Candles from the tallow of murderers will cure most illnesses, and a thief's little finger is good against fire. I've got one myself.
He raised his hand with the empty tankards and pointed to the ceiling. A shriveled scrap of blackened flesh was fixed by a nail to the beam. With a bit of imagination, it was possible to make out the shape of a finger.
This street has been struck by lightning on two occasions, but my tavern has never been hit.
Tungdil shuddered and paid up quickly, keen to escape before he was hit on the head by a dead man's finger. He set off to tell his friends of his discovery. The outcasts would be easier to find than he had imagined, although there was still the challenge of persuading his companions to dive into a pond. As he trudged through the alleyways of Hilchester, he realized that Bramdel hadn't told him the reason for his banishment. The word murder haunted his thoughts. At last, the laughter died down. Boindil ran a hand over his eyes to wipe away his tears of mirth, while the others lay back on their beds and struggled for breath.
"That was a good one, scholar," chuckled Boindil. "But joking aside, how do we get to their realm?"
Tungdil sighed.
"I just told you. I was quoting Bramdel exactly."
Boindil's grin disappeared.
"Let me get this straight. You're asking me to jump into a pond?"
He leaned forward and sniffed Tungdil's breath.
"Ah, no wonder. How many tankards have you had? Weights on my ankles, I ask you."
He noticed the grave expression on Tungdil's face.
"By the hammer of Vracus, I won't do it. Elria's curse is bad enough, but drowning ourselves on purpose."
He folded his arms in front of his chest and stuck out his chin, black beard a quiver.
"Not in a million cycles."
"How do we know that Bramdel's not a thirdling?" piped up one of the others. "He could have made up the stuff about the entrance to trick us into drowning."
Boindil whipped around.
"Exactly," he said fiercely. "It's a trick. We'll get there, and he'll be hiding in the bushes, waiting for us to drown in his confounded pond. I bet he's dreaming up a way to thieve our armor."
"There might be dwarf-eating fish in the water,"
ventured one of his companions. Tungdil raised his eyebrows.
"All right,"
he challenged them.
"Name me a dwarf who died by drowning."
"I've heard all kinds of terrible stories," said Boindil balefully. "I can't remember the poor fellow's names."
"I'm not talking about stories," persisted Tungdil. "I want names, names of friends of friends or relatives who died by drowning.
It seems to me that Elria had plenty of opportunity to kill us on the way to the Black Saddle, but no one died, as far as I know."
He stared into their wrinkly faces.
"Well?"
No one said a word. Boindil examined the runes on his axes while the others stared at the ceiling or rearranged their clothes.
"I won't do it," said Boindil at last. "I don't mind looking at the pond, but it had better be shallow. If it's deeper than my knees, we'll head for the tunnels like we said."
"Fine,"
said Tungdil, pulling off his boots. It seemed futile to discuss the matter any further, especially when he himself was beginning to doubt the wisdom of the scheme.
"We'll get moving as soon as I've had a bit of sleep."
He lay down on the straw mattress and dozed for a while, only to be woken by jangling chain mail. He looked up to see Boindil standing by his bed.
"I meant to tell you. I spoke to a merchant, and he reckoned he'd seen some orcs."
Tungdil sat up. "How long ago and where?"
"He said they were coming from the east, from Urgon, he thought. They were marching toward the Grey Range, and he said they were moving fast."
Tungdil leaped out of bed, fetched the map from his rucksack, and laid it on the floor for the others to see. He traced the route with his finger.
"They must have turned east around here," he surmised, pointing midway between the dead glade and John Balsur. By sticking close to the border with Urgon, they slip past the allied army and the Alfar without being seen. For an orc, Ushnots was remarkably cunning. Where exactly did the merchants say they were? Boindil placed a finger on the map. According to Tungdil's calculations, the spot was only 400 miles from the Fifthling Kingdom. Goragar was hilly, but there weren't any proper mountains or other obstacles to slow them down. The territory suited the dwarves, but their longer-legged foes would have the advantage. Orcs were formidable marchers. Tungdil rolled up the map and stowed it into his rucksack. Even if everything went to plan, he couldn't bank on recruiting the outcasts in time to save the Fifthling Kingdom. His boots were still wet, but he pulled them on regardless and reached for his cloak. "We're leaving," he told the others. "From now on, we only stop if we have to." The next orbit, the dwarves had a niggling feeling that something was wrong. It wasn't tiredness or stomach cramps or any physical sensation, just a general uneasiness that made them nervous and withdrawn. All around them, the grass was getting greener, as if to flaunt its victory over the perished land. But the burgeoning vegetation did nothing to ease their trepidation, and they longed for their mountain homes. The mood became tenser, and the dwarves more irritable, but they kept themselves going with the occasional song. After a time, the path led into a forest, and the singing dried up. From then they continued in silence, trudging bad-temperedly along the overgrown track. Tungdil had a fair idea what was causing their edginess, but he wasn't inclined to share the news. The others would hardly be heartened to know that they were travelling through Lacintiel, former home of the northern elves. The Alfar had conquered the kingdom many cycles ago and wiped out their cousins before invading the Golden Plains, killing the elves and founding the Alfar kingdom of John Balsur. Only Liutasil's elves in the dense forests of Al-Andor had survived the Alfar's crusade against their race. Tungdil suspected that he and his friends had crossed into the first of the fallen elven kingdoms, and that Lacintiel was expressing its old antipathy toward the dwarves. Either that, or the land was drenched in the sinister memory of Sitalia's slaughtered elves. Unfortunately, he hadn't reckoned with eagle-eyed Boindil, who spotted the remains of a statue half-hidden by a thicket of brambles and creepers.
"By Vrakus, if that isn't a statue of Sitalia," he exclaimed, bringing the little procession to a halt. "What's it doing in a godforsaken forest like this? Don't tell me we're in Al-Andor already."
Needless to say, the whole group looked to Tungdil for guidance.
"There's a chance we're in Lacintiel," their leader conceded quietly.
"Unbelievable,"
snorted Boindil, aiming a kick at the elegantly sculpted marble.
"First you ask us to jump into a pond, then you lead us straight to the heart of the pointy ears."
He stopped short and corrected himself.
"Straight to the heart of an elven kingdom. No wonder I've got the shivers. It's no place for a dwarf."
"If you've finished complaining," said Tungdil, "I suggest we carry on. You seem to have forgotten that we're friends with the elves."
"Tell that to the forest,"
growled Boindil, setting off behind him. He turned and glared at a nearby tree.
"Trip me up, and I'll hack you to pieces. Consider yourself warned."
It was probably coincidence, but at that moment the wind got up, whistling threateningly through the trees. Boindil whipped out his axes and banged them together, filling the forest with a high-pitched jangling of metal.
"Was that supposed to scare me?" he shouted defiantly. "Do it again at your peril."
Footsore and tired, the dwarves continued their journey, eating and drinking on the move. At dawn,
the tops of the trees were wreathed in mist. The sun was still rising slowly as they made their way out of the forest and stopped at the edge of a meadow. The terrain was completely flat, but the grass, a mixture of dead stalks and fresh new blades, came as high as their chests. Scattered about the meadow was the wreckage of an elven town, and beyond that, a pond, just as Bramdell had described. For some reason, the executioner had omitted to mention that the water was as black as the night. Devoid of light or sparkle, its surface swallowed every particle of sunlight. Tungdil was reminded of the dull, forbidding water of the dead glade. Boindil wouldn't stop shaking his head.
"I wouldn't have minded if you could see the bottom, but this..."
He pointed to the pond.
"It's the work of the perished land."
One of the others nodded.
"It's as black as pitch. I'll be darned if I dip my toe in it, let alone the rest of me."
"We need to get a proper look," said Tungdil, tramping through the grass. Tendrils of ivy twisted playfully over scattered blocks of stone. Unlike the elves of Alandor, the founders of Lysintiel had favoured solid, imposing buildings, but the weather and the Alfar had taken their toll, and it was difficult to imagine how the town had once looked.
"Don't wait for me. I'll catch up," said one of Tungdil's companions, stopping among the ruins.
Bigor's stone column was a stoneworking secondling who was drawn to masonry of any sort. He ran his callous fingers over crumbling carvings, cracked sculptures, and once beautiful friezes, the colours of which had faded in the sun.
"Not bad for a bunch of flower pickers," he said admiringly.
The dwarf studied the intricate workmanship and found no sign of faulty hammer strikes or careless chisel cuts. In spite of himself, he wished the elven town was still standing, so that he could see it in its original glory. Meanwhile, Tungdil had arrived at the pond. He looked around for Bigor, but the secondling was nowhere in sight.
"Bigor!"
he called.
"Don't worry, scholar. He'll be admiring the ruins," said Boindil.
"Oh, answering a call of nature," chuckled one of the others. "The grass will be glad of some water."
Tungdil peered at the pond. In front of him were the sorry remains of a pier, and further left, a tumble-down shrine, which, according to the worn inscription, was dedicated to Sitalia, goddess of the elves. A flight of stone steps led down to the water.
"Right. Here goes."
He crouched at the water's edge, pulled off his gloves, and hesitated briefly before lowering his index finger into the liquid darkness. The water felt cold.
"It seems harmless enough," he said to the others. "The pier reaches almost to the middle of the pond. With a proper run-up, we should be able to reach the..." "Hang on a second, scholar," interrupted Boindil. "I'm not in the habit of questioning your decisions, but you can't seriously be suggesting that we should jump in there?"
Tungdil didn't like exploiting his friend's weaknesses, but he was left with no choice.
"You're not scared, are you, Ironheart?"
He scooped up some water and threw it at the dwarf.
"Ooh," he teased. "Can you feel it trying to kill you? It's only water, you know."
The tactic worked. Boindil puffed out his chest, wounded honour triumphing over his instincts.
"Why would a warrior be afraid of Elria?" he asked proudly. "Look, I'll dive in and prove it."
He clambered onto the pier, but Tungdil held him back.
"Hold on. We can't leave without Bigor."
He called the mason's name and waited in vain for an answer.
"We'd better look for him. Everyone's spread out."
"I reckon he's been kidnapped by the forest," said Boindil, pulling out his axes. "Elvish trees can't stand us dwarves."
"You threaten them,"
commented one of his companions. "What do you expect?"
"For them to behave themselves,"
snapped Boindil, hacking at the high grass to work off his temper. They spread out and advanced in a line, sweeping the meadow for the missing dwarf and calling his name. Next to a marble column, shielded by head-high grass, they found Bigor, or what was left of him. At once, Boindil and the others formed a defensive ring around Tungdil and the corpse. Bigor's mail tunic had been pulled halfway over his head, and his leather jerkin ripped to shreds, exposing his torso. His flesh was covered in bite marks, and some of his bones were missing, including his ribs. The trampled grass around the body glistened moistly with blood.
"This was the work of an animal," reported Tungdil.
Boindil glared furiously at the sea of rippling stems that blocked their view in all directions.
"It was a thirdling trap," he growled. "Your friendly executioner was trying to feed us to his pet."
He shifted his weight, planting both feet firmly on the ground.
"The dwarf-eating monster won't be gobbling any more of our kinsfolk. I'll deal with the varmint, you'll see."
Noticing a wide channel of trampled grass, Tungdil concluded that the predator was by no means small, which led him to wonder why no one had heard it pouncing on Bigor. Judging by the dwarf's half-eaten remains, the creature had been disturbed mid-meal.
"It must be lurking nearby," he thought with a shudder.
He tried to predict the creature's next move. There were two possibilities. Either it meant to attack them, or it was waiting to finish its meal. Just then a strong wind gusted through the field. Amid the rustling grass, the hiss of an approaching arrow went unnoticed by the dwarves. Its arrival was so sudden and unexpected that the dwarf to the right of Boindil barely realized he was hit. Staggering backward, he raised a hand to his chest and closed his fingers disbelievingly around the black shaft protruding from his mail shirt. Pierced through the heart, he slumped to the ground.
"Halfar!" came the shouted warning from Boindil.
Not wanting to offer an easy target, he threw himself onto his belly. The arrow intended for him sailed over his head and pierced the back of the dwarf behind him. Groaning, the stricken dwarf keeled over. A third dwarf took two arrows to the chest. Seeing the arrows come thick and fast, Tungdil realized that there was more than one archer. By his reckoning, at least three Alfar were hiding in the grass, making it all but impossible for the dwarves to fight and win.
"Get down and crawl,"
he ordered, throwing himself to the ground. He lowered his voice.
"Make for the pond. We'll soon see whether Bramdil was telling the truth." "Are you blind or something?"
barked Boindil, wriggling through the grass beside him.
"This is the Perish Land. We can't."
Tungdil grabbed a handful of grass.
"Look, it's green, not grey. The Perish Land has been banished."
An arrow whistled over their heads.
"No more talking. I'll see you at the pond."
He pushed himself carefully across the ground, intent on disturbing as few blades as possible. The Alfar were bound to be looking for movement in the grass.
"What brought them here?"
he wondered feverishly.
"Lesintiel's occupation ended cycles ago."
It was too far north for Alfar scouts, especially when their troops were in action on the fringes of Alandor and Jon Balsur. Tungdil could only think that they knew of some secret weapon in the Fallen Kingdom that they were hoping to use against the elves. The rustling increased as if hundreds of Alfar were swarming through the meadow. During his long crawl toward the pond, Tungdil heard five more agonized screams. Seized by fury, he felt like drawing keenfire and confronting his pursuers, but common sense convinced him otherwise, thereby prolonging his life. The Alfar were expert marksmen, and neither mail shirts nor solid armor could halt the arrows that sped from their bows. A dwarf, stationary or moving, was an easy target, and Tungdil knew better than to break his cover. He hoped to Vrakas that his surviving companions would stay out of sight. Just then, Samusin, commander of winds and god of equilibrium, noticed the outnumbered dwarves. The wind changed direction, blowing across the pond toward the dwarves and their pursuers. Tungdil decided to get out his tinderbox and set light to the grass.
"Burn the meadow!"
he shouted, rejoicing at the sight of the dancing flames working their way up the dry stalks and spreading like lightning. A moment later, several other columns of smoke appeared above the field. The breeze fanned the flames, sweeping them toward the Alfar. Protected by the smoke, grass and flames, Tungdil kept crawling until he reached the edge of the pond. Glancing around, he spotted two of his companions. Of the others, including Boindil, he saw no sign. Before he could instruct his companions to dive into the water, a shadow fell over them, and a vast creature emerged from the field. The saddled bull was barely 10 paces away. It was wearing a helmet of gleaming tionium, and its horns were sheathed in metal. Smoke rose from its coat, and its hooves were singed, as Tungdil could tell from the acrid odor. There could be no doubt of its intentions. It turned to face the dwarves, lowering its broad head, scraping its hooves against the ground, and snorting aggressively. Its tail swept from side to side.
"Quick! To the pier!"
commanded Tungdil, drawing Keenfire. Deep down, he knew the axe could do nothing to stop the charging bull. The beast weighed at least 1/4 ton and was made of pure muscle without an ounce of fat.
"Dive into the water! It's our only chance!"
They started running. The bull watched them with fiery red eyes. Opening its jaws, it let out a blood-curdling roar, showed them its jagged incisors, and broke into a trot, accelerating as it thundered behind them, churning up the ground. Tungdil realized that the beast would be upon them before they reached the pier.
"Hey, over here, you cud-chewing brute!"
A split second later, Ironheart shot out of the grass. Grabbing the bull by its tail, he dug his heels into the churned-up soil and pulled back with all his might. The bull charged onward, dragging Boindil, whose boots carved 2 deep furrows in the ground. Suddenly it stopped and whipped around to glower at the intrepid warrior hanging off its tail.
"I'll teach you to eat my friends," shouted Ironheart, pulling one of his axes from his belt.
The blade cut a deep gash in the bull's behind.
"Keep going, scholar! I've got your back!"
Tungdil peered into the raging wall of flames that separated the pond from the meadow, but the Alfar were nowhere to be seen. After assuring himself that the coast was clear, he signaled for the others to follow and hurried onto the pier. Thereafter they were in full view of any lurking archers. From the corner of their eyes they watched as Boindil jabbed at the raging bull with one hand and clung to its tail with the other. Bucking and turning, the beast tried to shake itself free. But Boindil's grip was like iron, and he stayed out of reach.
"I've killed bigger beasts than you," the dwarf warned him. "What are you, an oversized cow? You won't be around much longer."
Swinging his axe rapidly, he hacked at the creature's legs. Crimson blood flowed from countless gashes. Then the hind legs caved in, and the bull bellowed with helpless fury.
"Now for your ribs," roared Boindil.
"Watch out! There!"
With a final shriek, the dwarf next to Tungdil toppled over, a second arrow piercing his back as he fell. Gurgling incoherently, he convulsed and died.
"Alfar!"
shouted Tungdil, stowing away his axe and grabbing his dead companion by the shoulders. He hoisted the body into the air and held it in front of him like a shield. Unable to see anything, he took a step back, only to hear his other companion fall prey to the Alfar's arrows. 5 times he heard the same sequence of noises, a soft whir, a jangle of chainmail, and the terrible sound of metal burrowing through sinew and flesh. The dead dwarf splashed into the water. Tungdil didn't dare raise his head above the corpse to look for his attackers.
Instead, he stumbled backward toward the end of the pier. "Listen to me, Boindil," he ordered, doing his best to shout. "You can't risk the pier. You'll have to wade in from the side."
Boindil was standing beside the bull, both hands on his axe, and aiming for the creature's sturdy neck.
"I'm not getting in that water," he shouted, swinging his axe. "This cow needs to be..."
Just then the bull tensed its mighty muscles, and its head jerked around. Its horns hit the dwarf's belly, knocking him off his feet. Boindil flew 4 paces through the air and splashed into the somber water of the pond. His weapon followed a split second later, disappearing with a gentle gurgle. Bubbles floated to the surface, but neither dwarf nor axe reappeared. Tungdil decided that his friend's unexpected flight was the work of Vrakus. He was preparing to launch himself after him when footsteps hurried down the pier. Even as he lowered the corpse to gauge the distance, his right shoulder was hit by an arrow. The strength drained out of his arm, and his makeshift shield slipped even lower, exposing more of his body. The Alf dispatched another missile, this time hitting Tungdil's chest. He crashed to the ground. Groaning, he tried to crawl out from under the corpse. Whether or not he reached the end of the pier was no longer of importance. His only chance of survival was to enter the water as fast as he could. His pursuers were getting closer. Glancing up, he saw a female Alf wearing a half-mask, her features veiled by a strip of black gauze. She was running toward him, calling something at the top of her voice. Without stopping, she raised a sickle-like weapon not dissimilar to Namora's and hurled it at his chest. "My life is in your hands," he muttered to Vrakus as he snapped the shaft of the arrow and rolled off the side of the pier. "I hope Bramdel wasn't lying." He let himself fall. The dark surface of the pond came closer and closer. Then, just as he was approaching the water, he came to a sudden halt. Someone had grabbed his weapons belt.
Pendleburg, southwest Ergon, Gerdlegard, spring, 6235th solar cycle.
"My uncle, King Lorimbas Steelheart of the Clan of the Stone Grinders, ruler of Lorimbur's folk, sends his heartfelt condolences for the loss of your nephew. Ergon has been deprived of an exceptional king," said Romo Steelheart, inclining his head in a gesture that was barely a bow. He was standing at the foot of a throne, and the throne was in a modest palace, in Romo's opinion, a humble fort. It was situated on the tallest of the 3 hills that made up Pendleburg, the capital of Ergon. Wood was a rarity in the mountainous kingdom, and so the people of Ergon built their houses of stone. From a distance, it looked as if the city were made of thousands of colored cubes. There were no tiled roofs, only flat stone slabs on which laundry, fruit, and meat were laid to dry. Pendleburg owed its colourfulness to the different types of rock available to the masons, who created mosaics and bold geometric patterns from the contrasting hues. Romo felt at home among the solid walls and soaring mountains, which bore comparison with the peaks of his native range.
"I didn't want to be a king," said the man on the throne. He was probably about 45 cycles old, small and rather portly. He pointed to a portrait of a young man with long fair hair. "Lothair was a true king of Ergon." His voice cracked, and he broke off, burying his lopsided face in his hands. Tears seeped between his fingers. Romo, who couldn't abide weakness, masked his scorn by staring at the ceiling until the sobs had subsided.
"Forgive me," said King Bellatane, wiping the salty tears from his clipped brown beard. "The loss is still very fresh. My dear brother, Lothair's father, died 7 cycles ago in the war against the trolls, and as for me..." He raised his hand and tapped his helmet. "I took a blow to the head.
Since then I have had a face like a lopsided pumpkin, and I have to wear this helmet or my skull will fall apart. I thought I'd suffered enough, but the gods stole my nephew. I loved him like a son. That was